My thanks again to William Black for coming on. And as I told you, he is a guy who does not pull punches and really laid it out in terms of our financial crisis, how it started and where it's going, and what we need to do to stop the next one from happening. We move on now to my next guest. When I first encountered him a couple of years ago, it was over a book he had written called When Technology Fails, and it really made an impact on me. It prompted me to go out and start preparing for disasters. I bought all kinds of stuff, water filters and medical kits and things that every home should have to prepare for whatever comes down the road. He's got a new book out. It's called When Disaster Strikes. His name is Matt Stein, and we're jumping right into our interview right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Matthew Stein is an engineer, author, and building contractor. He's a guy I've come to know fairly well through this program, and he's a person who he walks the walk and he talks the talk. I mean, he's the stuff we're going to talk about tonight about preparing for disaster are things that he has personally investigated and built and accumulated. He's become an expert on these topics. The new book, as I mentioned before the break, is called When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide for Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival. Matt, welcome back to the program.
George, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a real pleasure to be on Coast to Coast.
I want to talk about the potential disasters that that you envision. What are the more likely scenarios? And the one I want to start with is the one that's sort of toward the end of the book, and that is discussing the possibility of nuclear problems, potential Chernobyls. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, there's something like 442 nuclear power plants in the world, and we tend to assume that these plants are pretty safe because, after all, Chernobyl was a few decades ago, and Fukushima this year just happened because of a tidal wave and a huge earthquake, and we assume, well, you know, those are extenuating circumstances. But the reality is that all of these nuclear reactors in the world are dependent on a stable grid in order to keep themselves cooled. So let me explain what I mean by that. Every nuclear reactor, or most all of them except for the Chernobyl design, which they decided was not so hot because it blew up just a few months after starting, they have these things called fuel rods inside the reactor, and they're highly radioactive. And the fuel rods, if left alone beside each other, end up with a chain reaction that goes out of control and burns them up and explodes, like what happened in Fukushima. So they have these other things called control rods that are like fingers that interweave with each other. There's fuel rods interwoven with control rods. And they control a reaction by moving the control rods in and out to slow down the reaction so it doesn't burn up and blow up like happened in Fukushima. So all of these reactors are designed so that when there's a failure condition, like they're all of a sudden the grid has gone down, that the control rods slam into the fuel rods and it slows the reaction down. Problem is, even though it slowed down a lot, within 8 hours, if there's no coolant in there that's circulating, they're going to burn up and melt down and start exploding like happened in Fukushima. Well, normally, these are made with backup diesel generators. So if the grid is down and there's a control failure, then it starts slowing itself down. And normally, these big, giant diesel generators kick in, and they keep coolant flowing in there, and they keep it from going critical and blowing up like Fukushima did. Well, problem is that, say we had a big solar storm, you know, a really big solar storm, like bigger than we've had in a long time, like the one we had back in 1921. Well, that solar storm would induce thousands of volts and thousands of amps in all of the power lines around North America and South America, pretty much anywhere except for the tropical zones. And these would cook the grid as we know it. So suddenly, you'd have a loss of grid, and all of these reactors, almost all these reactors around the world, will start shutting down, and their control rods will slam in, and their diesel generators will kick on. And the problem is that these places only have a week's worth of fuel. So if you've got a huge meltdown, like would happen in a big solar storm, and these things happen fairly often in geological time, like every 70 years on the average, we get a huge one. Problem is that the last one happened in 1921. In 1921, the world was just electrified a little here and there. There was no big power grid, the interconnected. There was no microelectronics like there are today, which is extremely sensitive to the voltage and power fluctuations, these solar storms. So the world was, like, pretty stable. So when they had a big, giant solar storm in 1921, all it did was it burned down some telegraph stations and it burned down a couple of power stations around the world. But, you know, it was kind of no big deal because the world was used to getting by without electricity anyways. But today, if it was to happen, then suddenly we'd have perhaps 400 Fukushima Chernobyl-type things happening around the world all at the same time. When those stations run out of backup diesel fuel, or if those diesel generators fail because of the induced currents from the solar storm, then, you know, within a week's time, they're all melting down, or perhaps within a day's time, if there's other failures and the diesel fuel, diesel power generators don't kick in, we start having meltdowns all over. Now, in America, one-third of the American population is 50 miles or less from a nuclear power plant. So this is something that's really serious. This is a situation where it's guaranteed to happen because, you know, we've had three of these events in the last 152 years. We had two of them 5 days apart in 1859 that was twice as strong as the one that happened in 1921. Now, the last time we had a significant storm that's not nearly as big as the 21 was 1989. We had one that was one-tenth the size of the 21 storm, and it caused one of these huge transformers on the grid to burn up in Quebec, and that cut power to 9 million people for about 6 hours. And you think, well, that's no big deal. Well, back in 2000, and I think it was 2006, maybe 2003, we had one of these solar storms that caused 14 of these huge transformers in South Africa to get either fully damaged or totally cooked or partially damaged. And that screwed up the grid in South Africa for over a year. They had to have rolling blackouts throughout South Africa. In other words, you couldn't tell. It was really tough to run your business because you'd be out of power for 5 or 6 hours of the day. If you didn't have a backup generator of your own, then your food would start rotting in your refrigerators and melting. And, you know, try to run a shopping center when you're out of power for 6 hours in the middle of the day. Pretty tough thing to do. Well, those storms were tiny compared to the 21 storm or the 1859 storm. And according to the ice core samplings, we're overdue. We're about 10 years overdue for the next one, and we're now coming into a solar maximum that some people are worried is going to be another super solar storm kind of maximum that could cause this to happen. Now, there's solutions to protecting our grid from this and protecting the world from melting down and the end of the world as we know it. But the problem is that so far they're just studying the problem and they're not doing anything about it. Now, for 50 years, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers knew we had a problem with the dikes around New Orleans. And the engineers are real smart guys, and they're telling the government this is a disaster waiting to happen. And, you know, if we don't do something, the next major hit of a hurricane and much of New Orleans is going to go away. Now, the experts were warning the government, but the government said, you know, hey, there's other things I want to spend the money on. It's not too sexy to fix something that doesn't seem to be broken. So we're just going to put the money elsewhere. Well, right now, they're doing the same thing with the grid that keeps life as we know it working, keeps the stock exchange going, keeps the food going, keeps the internet going, keeps everything in our world rolling. And they're not really doing anything to protect it because a lot of it's privatized, and they're just not going to go spend $1 billion to go protect it against something that may happen someday. It just doesn't work that way. Without a government mandate or the government putting a program to do it, it's just not happening. So that's the situation is right now today we have an incredibly vulnerable grid where in North America they've got something like they assume that one of these big storms, like the 1921, if the 1921 storm happened, according to a U.S. government report, very extensive scientific study and report. If that 1921 storm happened today, they assume or they calculate that roughly 350 of these huge power transformers will get cooked. Now, what does that mean? Well, right now, each of these transformers costs over $1 million. They're custom made. It used to be that there was a one-year waiting list, and none of them are made in America anymore. We don't have the capability to make a single one in this country.
Oh, boy.
And the current waiting list for one of these transformers is now gone from 1 year to 3 years for a single one. Now, one or two burn up, no big deal. But the 1921 storm, it's estimated 350 of these would cook. And the world manufacturing capacity is less than 100 a year. Now, if there's 350 cooked in North America, worldwide, you're probably going to see a couple thousand cooked. And probably most of the places in the world that can actually make these, they'd be cooked too. So how are they going to make them without power? So here you are where, without doing something proactive to protect our grid, we have a situation that is guaranteed to happen. It is just a matter of time. It's like rolling the dice. It's like waiting for Armageddon to come up. And then they can say, God, we didn't know that was going to happen. Just like they said, we didn't know New Orleans was going to get wiped out by a direct hit from a hurricane. And that's a load of bull because they know it. The reports have said it. The scientists and engineers who studied it know the problem. But the people that make the decisions haven't spent the money to protect us.
My gosh. And then, you know, you add to that, you know, just being without power is going to be bad enough for an extended period of time. But then the added prospect of these nuclear plants melting down is pretty scary. I guess it would be ridiculous to suggest something as simple as having a month's supply of diesel fuel for their backup generators to be on hand. Go ahead.
A month will help, but won't really do it. It turns out that it takes about a year of cooling down these reactor cores and slowing down the reaction in order to be able to decommission a reactor. So they actually need a year's supply. Now, I was talking to Arne Gundersen, who was a senior VP at a major nuclear company until he became a whistleblower, and they basically bankrupt him and ruined him. He had a master's of science in nuclear engineering, number one in his class at RPI. And he said that right now, 8 months after Fukushima happened, if they lose cooling for 38 hours, it still melts down. So after 8 months of cooling, it only takes 38 hours of loss of cooling to melt down. So we actually need over a year's worth of diesel at every single nuclear plant in the world to guarantee that. Now, someone in the government, he was saying, he was talking to a senior official in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they laughed, and they said, well, it's not a problem because the government has promised us that they're going to make sure they have diesel trucks delivering like clockwork to every single nuclear power plant in the country. And it's like, oh, yeah, when nobody can communicate, the grid is down, the internet's down, people are starving, there's pandemonium everywhere, the stock market is gone, the Washington, D.C. is essentially gone, or at least their ability to function and do anything is gone. But somehow they're going to make sure that all that pandemonium is going to go on, but those diesel trucks are going to show up like clockwork at the nuclear power plants all around the country to keep them going. It's like, yeah, right. And I believe in the Tooth Fairy, and I believe in Santa Claus, too.
I don't want to make this whole conversation about nuke plants, but before we leave Fukushima, I do want to talk about that. How it is even possible to build a nuclear power plant right there on the ocean in a earthquake zone. I mean, all the Pacific Rim is an earthquake zone, and of course, Japan is rocked by earthquakes all the time. You build something there and don't foresee the possibility of a tsunami. I just wonder what other kinds of stories we're not being told about Fukushima, because it's dropped off the radar screen. We're not paying attention to it, and I get a feeling it's far from over, that situation.
It's far from over, and it's not something that's going away. And the radiation released from that is many times worse than the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs, just like it was out of Chernobyl. And think about this. In Chernobyl, they said, oh, only a couple hundred people died directly and stuff. Well, when they did the epistemological study, in other words, the medical study looking at statistically how many people were dying of cancers and this, that, and the other thing before Chernobyl versus post-Chernobyl, they figure there's a couple hundred thousand deaths locally from directly responsible from Chernobyl, and over a million deaths worldwide, and over 3 million people with severely compromised immune systems. They call it the Chernobyl necklace. It's so common in that part of the world where you look at people and they've got these giant bumps around their neck from the thyroid cancers and tumors. And they say, they also call it Chernobyl AIDS. It's like these people, their whole life is screwed up, their health is screwed up. It's like they got AIDS, only it's from radiation. Now imagine 400 of those happening in the world. How could life go on in the world as we know it? So, yeah, this is a really big deal. And Chernobyl or Fukushima's not over. You know, and the results, we don't really know for a long time what's going to happen. But I know a lot of people have been sick in the West Coast of the United States. And a lot of people who are not normally sick are getting sick. So I can't help but think that this radiation is compromising the immune system of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people.
Well, I guess the obvious question, Matt, is why even try to survive if it's going to be that bad, if something like this happens?
Well, you know, when that's a big question a lot of people ask. They say, just give me a bullet and it'll be over. And the truth is you don't know exactly what's going to go on, but I do know that when the organism, the biological organism, the human being is threatened, that the natural-born instinct, the survival instinct kicked in, and something in you says, you know, I've got to survive. I've got kids, I've got a wife, I've got family. I'm going to do what I can to survive, and that's where being prepared makes such a difference, because having the knowledge at your fingertips to know what to do. I mean, in the nuclear situation, there's sort of three major scenarios. There's dirty bombs, there's meltdowns and nuclear meltdowns, and then there's the unthinkable, the detonation of a nuclear device. And what you need to do, the strategy to protect yourself and optimize your chances for a good outcome, are different from each of these. And believe me, you know, a nuclear device went off in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and the world didn't end. I mean, it killed a lot of people, but for those downwind people, if you know the strategy, then you'll be chances of coming through it well are much greater. And certainly the last thing you want to do is go outside and run when there's a nuclear bomb go off, because the first 24 hours, the radiation is extremely high, and your best bet is to hole up in a place where you're as shielded from the radiation as possible. By the end of the second day, the radiation levels are down to a 100th of what they were in the first few hours after a nuclear detonation. If you're downwind and you've got actual fallout falling in your area. So knowing the right strategies and how to protect yourself makes the difference between almost certain death or life-threatening illness versus coming out of it probably okay. So you know, it isn't just give me a bullet. It's tell me what to do so I can do the right thing.
Well, we'll talk about your other potential disaster scenarios when we come back after the break. But in general, you're suggesting that people at least need to be ready to make it for a week or a month on their own without any help.
Because
all these scenarios, that's what could happen.
That's correct. You know, when the disaster's really big, you know, they talk about giving a 72-hour grab-and-run kit, and that's a wonderful thing to have. But there's a bit of a misnomer, because 72 hours, that's 3 days. And, you know, in a real big disaster, chances are it's going to be a week, maybe 2 weeks. And in a huge meltdown, sure, you might have to be on your own for months. So definitely being ready and being prepared makes the difference between survival and death, life and death, or in the least, between coming out of it pretty well or extreme suffering. You know, it makes that kind of difference. You and your family, you want to suffer extremely, or do you want to be, you know, relatively good shape? And that's what the preparation makes the difference between.
All right. Matthew Stein is my guest, author of the new book, When Disaster Strikes. When we come back, we'll talk about some other terrible scenarios that we'd better prepare for, and then get into some specific advice on how to get you and your family ready. You too, taking us to the break. earlier in the program a paper written by Bill Black that we were posting on the website. I think our webmaster Lex, I sent it to him now. So if you were looking for it before and couldn't find it, it should be up there soon. We're talking with Matt Stein, the author of When Disaster Strikes, some pretty grim scenarios, but some positive advice on how you can prepare yourself and your family for some pretty bad stuff that could be coming down the pike. That conversation continues right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Matt Stein, I guess people could say, disaster scenarios, that's pretty far-fetched. The chances of it hitting me are pretty slim. But actually, a lot of Americans live in areas that are disaster prone. You have a description in the book, When Disaster Strikes, about a scenario that unfolded in Haiti. And if it the similar thing happened here, we'd be in a lot of trouble.
Not every disaster is the end of the world as we know it, that's for sure. I mean, the solar storm is a matter of time and luck, but there's tons of disasters happening all the time. And the big ones are called high-impact, low-frequency events, or HILF. But naturally, we're seeing lots of regular stuff happening. And, I was on the East Coast a couple months ago, in September, late September, and I was speaking at the Mother News Conference. And I often start my talks and I ask them, how many people think the world can keep going the way it's going now and everything's going to be okay? And after giving this talk to thousands of people, I haven't had a single person raise their hand yet and say they think it's okay the way we're going. Not one. Then I ask, how many people think we've passed the tipping point in our world, that we're collapsing our planet no matter what? It's like the giant train wreck that's headed for the brick wall and or going off the cliff, and there's nothing we can do to stop it. And usually about 25% of the people raise their hands at that question, but something different happened this fall. I was in the East Coast, and when I asked that question, two-thirds to three-quarters of the people raised their hand thinking that we passed the tipping point already, that we're going to collapse the natural and financial systems of our world no matter what we do. Then I asked the question, how many people think that we got to get shaken up really bad, like way worse than Fukushima, way worse than Hurricane Katrina? And people, the governments and people running this world and running the business and the powers that be will finally snap to and say, what we're doing, business as usual, is collapsing the natural systems that keep life as we know it going on this planet. If we don't change the way we're doing things, we're gonna all go down. There's a Yvon Chouinard, the Patagonian guy, he likes to quote a quote. It's not his quote, but he likes to say, there is no profit to be made on a dead planet. And I'll have to agree with that. So the scary thing now is people are really getting it. And large numbers of people actually think that there's no turning back, that we passed the tipping point. Now, I'm in the group that I call the optimistic doomer group. I honestly believe that we can change it, that we can prevent global collapse. But I also believe that business as usual guarantees that collapse is around the corner. But I still think that we can get shaken up badly enough that we might make the massive changes needed to prevent that collapse. So my book, When Disaster Strikes, is the definitive guide to emergency prep and crisis survival. And it's brand new. It just officially released this last Wednesday. So it's actually been shipping for about 10 days from Amazon. It's just hitting the bookstores as we speak. So it's brand spanking new. And it'll give you the latest, up-to-date, comprehensive, and definitive advice for what you need to know, do, and have on hand to keep your family safe in times of trouble.
You know, what I don't see in here is a discussion of sort of like an economic crisis, a collapse of the financial system. Maybe there are references in here, but not a specific scenario that you talk about in the section of disasters right up front. I don't know if you heard the first 2 hours of the program, but it sure sounds like there's some bad stuff coming down the road in that regard. Would you classify that as the kind of disaster that your advice would help with?
Well, my advice as far as prep and self-reliance and sustainability and putting together a lifestyle that can hopefully help you survive that is there in the book. But I'm not directly dealing with financial crisis and collapse, though I do believe, I've outlined six trends that I refer to as the perfect storm, six trends converging on collapse. And I do believe that these trends mean that financially in our world, until we actually totally restructure the way we do business, that we're inevitably headed for financial and business collapse as well as these other things. So the first of which is that totally in our face is called the peak in world oil production. I mean, officially, we passed the peak around 2005, 2006 in terms of regular sweet crude oil, and oil is what really greases the system and makes our world go round. And it's an exponential increase in the use of oil and other fossil fuels and nuclear fuels that has fueled the exponential global growth in the global economy. And we hit a plateau back in around 2005, 2006. Now, regular crude's been depleting and declining, but we've been ramping up biofuels and tar sands. But the problem is that biofuels and tar sands, just they're ecologically tough on the environment, plus there's just not that much of them. So we're not going to be able to keep ramping them up forever to make up for the decline in regular crude. So we're basically struggling just to keep production flat right now. And we've experienced 10% annual growth for the last, 100 years or so. So now we're kind of hitting that wall, and you can see that it's messing with the world's economies. I mean, when oil hit almost $150 a barrel in 2008, that, I believe, was the straw that broke the camel's back and burst the bubble, and the world's global economy just crashed. And I don't see it really coming back unless we discover the Star Trek dilithium crystals, or we find that magical over-unity machines are real and we're able to implement them and get off this growth curve we've been on based on fossil fuels and uranium.
One of the other ones you talk about, and I'll touch on this and then we'll get into the practical suggestions, is pandemic.
Pandemic is huge. And it's another one, like the solar storms, that is kind of rolling the dice, and you don't really know when it's going to happen. It's happened throughout history, and we believe that our technological civilization has solved the pandemic problem. But now we're seeing that bugs, superbugs, are growing resistant to antibiotics at a faster rate than we can make new antibiotics. And so pandemic is real. It's a big issue. Right now we have extreme drug-resistant tuberculosis. It's a superbug that's out there, has the potential to be a pandemic any time. We have MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph infection, and there's some new ones coming along that are worse than MRSA. So we've got a situation ripe for pandemic when you combine global air travel, along with factory farms that feed massive amounts of antibiotics to our factory farm animals to keep them healthy so that we have a higher profit margin, but it's basically turning them into factories to make super antibiotic-resistant bugs. So we're ripe for pandemic, and the last big pandemic, really serious one in the world, was the Spanish flu back, I think, in 1919, killed 20 to 100 million people, somewhere in that range. They assume somewhere around 50 million people worldwide, far more than World War I and World War II put together. And in those days, it pretty much shut down travel. It shut down all kinds of systems and food deliveries. But, in those days, it wasn't that bad because you could just, go over the hill and barter and trade some food with a local farmer and everything was okay. Nowadays, if that kind of pandemic got loose in the world, then all hell would break loose because we're not the 1920s anymore. We can't just go over the hill and get some eggs from the local farmer.
Well, you make that point is that the percentage of people who know how to raise their own food is so small, especially in this country anymore.
Yeah, we've gone from almost half the population involved in food production in one way or another, certainly 20 or 30%. Now down to less than 2%. So very tiny number of people now are involved with making the food for the rest of us, in at least in the Western world, and that's where we live. So, yeah, the same skills and talents that someone in our grandparents' towns knew how to make, grow, or fabricate pretty much everything needed for a reasonable standard of living just 200 years ago or 100 years ago even. And nowadays, very few of us know those basic skills anymore, very, very few. And that's what my first book, When Technology Fails, kind of focuses on a lot of those old-fashioned technologies. And so it's really an excellent book to cover your you-know-what in the event of a major meltdown. Whereas the new book, When Disaster Strikes, is more like the Emergency Prep and Crisis Survival Handbook with fully updated information on specific disasters, a lot of them smaller, like, you know, superstorms, surviving a winter storm in extreme weather without heat and power, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes, what do you do? You know, EMP, solar storms, yeah, that's a big deal. Nuclear catastrophe, that's a big deal. But some of these things are much smaller. Just, you know, power's out for a few days and it's really cold. But how do I deal with it?
Well, things can go downhill, as you noted in both of the books. Things can go downhill really quickly in terms of, for example, food. I mean, you know, most of us live in cities. The food is delivered. If you had to have deliveries were cut off for a week, if everybody made a run on the stores, could get pretty hungry pretty quick.
Oh, yeah. I live in Truckee, Lake Tahoe, where the Donner Party had their infamous barbecue about 150 years ago, where they resorted to cannibalism when, you know, they had a winter with no food. Nowadays, we call it the Donner Party syndrome. When Donner Pass closes and the truck deliveries stop because and the tourists are in town, 3 hours later, the shelves are bare. You know, all the fresh food, the bread, the milk, the butter, gone. 3 hours. You know, the tourists in town and the truck stop running, and it's just, they just run down to the store and there's hordes of people there and the lines are like all the way down the aisles are the cashier register lines, and in 3 hours they've emptied most of the shelves in the store. And you can bet in a big situation where people know they're going to be without food for a while in every city in America, it's going to be the same situation. It'll be that Donner Party syndrome happening everywhere. So if you're not ready ahead of time, then you're going to be one of the fools stuck in line, scrambling for that last little bit that's on the shelf.
I know that you mentioned this in passing in the book, but I want to ask you about it. It's the stigma that comes along even in talking about this. Well, you must be one of those survivalist guys. You want to live out in the woods and eat sticks and nothing like this could ever happen, and it's just paranoia to be even thinking about something so disastrous happening. Surely the government would come to our rescue.
Yeah, well, we saw in New Orleans how fast and effective the government was in coming to your rescue. Think about how you'd feel if you were a parent and your child had to drink out of the ditch water in New Orleans, totally unprotected, and maybe they're puking and vomiting and having diarrhea because they got some nasty bugs in that dishwater, and you could have bought a backcountry filter for $70 that would filter it out, or you could have taken a bottle of Clorox bleach and put 5 drops in a quart of water, but you got to let it sit for a while before it does its magic on it. Or if you didn't even know that, if you had the knowledge, like I teach in both of my books about SODIS, solar disinfection, where you could go out and scavenge through the garbage cans and find some clear spring water bottles and fill them up with water and lay them in the sun, and 6 hours later the UV of the sun has done its job. That's just common sense. That's just doing the right thing. Now, emergency prep is like car insurance. You know, nobody I know says, wow, I've got car insurance, I think I want to get in a head-on collision today. It's like, no, you know, you buy the insurance, and you hope to God you never need it, but if some fool's texting on their phone and goes through the stop sign and slams into your car and you're hurt and you're wrecked and your car is totaled, or maybe you slip, you know, skid out in some ice and due to nobody's fault and spin around and wreck your car, you thank God you got that insurance to cover it. And emergency prep's the same way. You do your best. You cover as many possible scenarios as you can, and you pray and hope to God you never need the stuff. But if that day comes when you need it, you thank God you had it. You know, back in 1984, it was my second or third time climbing El Capitan, in Yosemite Valley. We got hit by record-breaking heat on Memorial Day weekend. No one expected that kind of heat, 100-plus degree temperatures in the south-facing walls. I'm 2,000-plus feet off the ground. On the third day of our climb, We ran out of I could have finished the water we had with breakfast and still been thirsty. We made it last till the middle of the day before we drank our last sip, but we were pretty miserable then. And then in the afternoon of vigorous, hard climbing to get to the top, we were totally bone dry. When I tried, my partner had asked me a question, and I tried to answer. I'm like 100 feet up on the rope, and he's asked me how it's going. I try to answer and be like, my tongue would stick to the roof of my mouth. I start gagging and retching. It's like super glue stuck my tongue to my mouth, and I start gagging. I was so miserable. We got off. We climbed with our headlamps on till the middle of the night. Midnight, we got off. We found the nearest mud puddle, stuck our faces in it, and drank. I guarantee you, if you're as thirsty as I was on that day in 1984, and all you've got is a scummy, green, disgusting ditch or duck pond water, you will drink it. You will not be able to keep yourself from drinking that water. You won't be able to do that. And, boy, I sure want my backcountry water filter for my grab-and-run kit so I can stick it into that scummy water and pump and get good, clean, safe drinking water out of that. And because I know you will drink it if you're thirsty like I went. You won't be able to stop yourself.
Well, I should say that that was after I read When Technology Fails and went shopping a few days later. That was the first thing I bought was a water system, and I bought some water pills as well. Would that be top of the list for the stuff people need to buy right away?
That's top of the list. You know, and another item that's really big on the list is a headlamp, because, you know, in a crisis situation, often power's out. You might have to be moving when it's dark. You might have to be working on your car in the dark or putting on chains in the snow, whatever. So a headlamp, it's like a flashlight with an elastic band that sticks on your head, and it's totally waterproof. You could swim across the river with your grab-and-go kit in your arms and get out the other side and keep going. That's a big item.
Solar-powered ones, right? Solar-powered.
Well, no, they're battery-powered, but you can have your solar-powered charger so that you can have a bunch of backup batteries with a solar charger so you can recharge those things. And then another thing that's really important that people don't think about is a colloidal silver generator, because 2,000 years ago, Alexander the Great, he didn't know anything about germ theory, but he knew that if he brought water for his soldiers in wooden urns, something happened to the water, it would turn, and his soldiers would start getting sick. And a soldier that's vomiting and has diarrhea and dysentery on the battlefield is not good for much. But he knew that if he stored that water in silver urns, then his soldiers didn't get sick. And a healthy soldier is a strong soldier on the battlefield. So it turns out that charged silver particles have this sort of magical property where they're toxic to all known pathogenic bacteria, but non-toxic to human beings. And this guy, a physicist named Bob Beck, figured out how to make tiny charged silver particles for very little money. So all modern silver generators are based on Bob Beck's original invention that was, I don't know, a couple decades back. He just went to sleep one night after reading medical research about how charged silver particles had saved people from amputation and knocked infections and helped the bodies boost the body's microelectric healing properties. He went to sleep at night wondering how he could make such particles in a reasonable way, and he woke up with the plans in his head for how to make the modern colloidal silver generator. So that's something I think everyone should have in their grab-and-go kit, the ability to make a pharmacy in a jar for pennies a day if necessary.
I remember last time you were here and I interviewed you, there were a couple of people who wrote in and say, that's crazy, that colloidal silver, you can overdo it and it'll turn you blue.
Well, you can. There is a guy that Fox News and others showed on TV, and after he had a serious skin condition, psoriasis, that didn't respond to any over-the-counter medicines or pharmaceuticals. And for 16 years, he'd made a quart a day of colloidal silver and pounded it. So 16 years and a quart a day, that's over.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Matt, hold on. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. We'll resume that part of the conversation. Then I'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions for Matt Stein, author of the new book, When Disaster Strikes, The Righteous Brothers, with a classic from way back in 1966, taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM.